I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the television shows of 1992, here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Lisko.
And I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, an AI recreation of Emily St. James.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
This is the weekend when we all got briefly worried that Zoom is like stealing all of our identities. And now we're not sure. We're just kind of like, they're maybe just kind of slightly stealing our identities.
Yeah, they issued a new statement that made me slightly less concerned that they're stealing my face, but.
Well, they're stealing my face, but that's because I signed a document saying they could. I was like, please, yeah. Please do
right,
so.
Exactly. Your licensing you deal is, I'm sure, very reasonable also.
Yeah.
With us today, as you just heard, the dulcet tones of Catherine Van Arendonk, critic at Vulture, to talk with us today about Murphy Brown, specifically the premiere of season 5, You Say Potato, I Say Potato, depending on how you spell it, because Dan Quayle, you know, doesn't know how to spell it. But also to talk about just Murphy Brown in general. Thank you so much, Catherine, for being here to talk about this with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Anything I can do to help push back against the increasing memory hole Murphy Brown phenomenon
that
our culture is suffering from, I'm very happy to do. And it is just wild to me that we are somehow still in this place where Murphy Brown is like impossible to get or watch and like is like fading from the distant memory, even though there was an incredibly like buzzy revival, like just just a couple years ago. Like it just is like it can't exist anymore, which I think is,
you know, what's interesting for, so I, my knowledge history with Murphy Brown seems to mostly be that my mother and my stepmother both really liked it. So they watched it a lot. And I remember watching episodes of it. And it is burned in my brain in terms of the fact that she was iconic, right? Like even to a, you know, 10 or 12 year old boy, you know, in Canada, I was like, this person means something. And I agree with you that like, obviously CBS thought the same thing because they tried to do a revival. Was it CBS or NBC?
Because I feel CBS.
Yeah. Okay, it did. And then the revival happened post the Will and Grace revival, correct? So they thought like that there was a chance that
the real impetus for that was the Roseanne revival. Like the Roseanne revival came along. And like, I think that they were announced Murphy Brown before Roseanne debuted, but Roseanne debuts and just totally blows everyone's expectations of what a revival can be out of the water. Then Murphy Brown came on and did not match those expectations.
So I'm curious, obviously, on both of your perspectives on this, because I feel like the show Murphy Brown was political to some degree, right? Like, it wasn't a political show, conceptually speaking, or was it?
No, I mean, not conceptually speaking, but it was always a show that lived in the real world of politics. Like, all of its references, all of its sort of the kinds of stories that she would be covering, because her job was as the one of the, I don't think technically she was the anchor. I think Jim was the anchor, but she was like a co-anchor and like the lead reporter on a weekly news magazine show a la 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. Her nemesis was Jane Pauley. And the show like existed in the real world. Like, they were covering the savings and loans crisis, which was like a huge deal at this point. They were constantly talking about specific political figures. They were making very topical references. It was pretty clearly that they were she was a Democrat, but was always very like neutral on the air. Talked about like corruption. I think it was political in that sense, in the sense of being like, you know, engaged with what we would think of as news politics, but it was also incredibly and explicitly political throughout the show, as far as the kind of issues type of storytelling that it was always about. There would regularly be episodes about like labor issues, about all kinds of certainly this whole episode that we're going to be talking about is very political from an issues standpoint, but like,
and from a reality perspective, like reality. They literally
right but like, you know, I think it is unusual for both of those things to come together. It was like sort of the issuesy political storytelling that the show was doing combined with like the real world political references that it liked to make.
It was a newsroom show on top of everything else, right?
Sort of the nexus for that. But the explicit fabric of it was sitcom, which even now going back and watching it is a kind of hilarious because it's not structurally sitcom in a lot of ways.
It's very much from the Norman Lear school of making television, which is weird because it has a lot of surface similarities with the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mm-hmm. But like, the Mary Tyler Moore Show was more interested in interpersonal relationships, and like, it had political episodes, but like, its mean was, we're going to return to Mary hanging out with Rhoda, and then she has her friends at work, and she and Lou have this like great relationship that is not romantic, but you can ship them if you want. And many fans did. But the Norman Lear shows were like, this week, Archie Bunker is going to talk about inflation. And you're okay, great. And Murphy Brown's very simple. But another thing I think is true of this show is that it was political in its like central idea of
100%.
A woman who is bold and brassy and takes no prisoners and like has a big important job and everyone has to listen to her. And I mean, we can dig a little bit more into how that plays into the way that Dan Quayle reacted to her. But from the pilot on, it's like, this woman is a fully dimensional character in a way that, like, I don't want to say 80s TV wouldn't regularly allow, because there are a lot of great, there's honestly probably more great roles for women, especially of Candace Bergen's age in television in like 1988 when the show debuted, than there are right now. But it was very much like, this woman doesn't need a man to be okay. And like that in and of itself, like, made some people just a little bit triggered, if you will.
Absolutely.
I went back and I watched the pilot for this also.
Same.
And it opens, the premise of the pilot, it opens to her returning to the workplace after a period away. And you're not sure why in the beginning. But the very first thing that you see is this opening camera pan over the art on her walls. And they are all framed magazine covers of her. And they are like her standing next to a president, her being like, it's like she's the best reporter of all time. There's like an Esquire cover that like is like, what man could be man enough for this woman? There's like a Star, you know, like a tabloid one that's like she's like the mother of an alien baby or something. It's like Fabulous Over 40 on a Vanity Fair or something. Like, it is very much like the entire premise of the show is she is this iconic, unusual, remarkable woman. And then you learn that she has been away and is now returning to work because she went to rehab because she had an alcohol problem and is now kicked cigarettes and alcohol. And so, like, from the jump, like, that's a wild way to start any show, like, now. And I think in 1988 must have been like, what the hell are we
watching?
Did
they ever tap back into her alcoholism?
Oh, no, yeah. Yes.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, it appears, I mean, sort of less so in later season. That's less a part of her story. But over the first couple seasons, that's something that I don't think they ever do like that exploitative like relapse arc thing for her. But it is definitely a touchstone that they that they come back to a couple times. And in particular, it's sort of meant to signal her obsessive compulsive, like her really... you know, the way
control
that she,
issues.
Yeah. And the way that she digs into things and the way that like she has made not traditional housewife her whole identity, which is like this is all of these are tropes that we would associate with male protagonists, right? The like heavy drinking, heavy smoking, heavy working person. But it's Murphy Brown. And Murphy, of course, also.
Which is why the baby stuff is so great, which we'll obviously talk about.
I do want to say that I think I struggle with Murphy Brown in the whole. I think as a whole show, like if you watch all 10 seasons, it really has a point where it just kind of goes downhill and never recovers, which is true of most shows that run 10 seasons. But I really think the first four seasons have their ups and downs, but they're all show run by Diane English.
Yeah.
And Diane English has a really clear vision of who this person is and where she wants to take her. And every time the show starts to drift a little bit too far into like easy political humor, she always like brings it back to Murphy is a complicated, difficult person. And the second she leaves, and we literally watched her last episode and her first episode and the first episode without her for this episode. And the second she leaves, the show just kind of becomes this much simpler, baser version of itself. I think I say potato, you say potato with an E, is, pretty good episode. But if you watch the season four finale next to it, you're like, oh, OK, this is written by someone who really cares about all of this.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
So she leaves in season four. So the show goes on for six more seasons without her. Is that, is that correct?
And then she comes back for the revival.
For the revival, right.
Yeah. But I believe she like co-show ran or show ran the final season. And the final season
is
okay.
Yeah, so 10 is really interesting. The big arc of season 10, the last like real final season, the revival is its own thing. The big arc is that Murphy gets breast cancer. And so that is also its own whole story. Yeah. And you can feel the return of some of the complexities of what her life is like and the show's interest in doing storytelling that is about, you know, big like women's issues kinds of things, which I think is interesting. You know, the other thing I was going to say is that the way that Murphy is written in the first few seasons versus later, it is so interesting because, as I was saying before, it's not really a sitcom structure in a lot of ways, like, or it's not the stories do not have what I would think of as like a workplace sitcom, because it's almost always interpersonal stuff, right? Like, we're fighting, there's like a circumstance at work, and it is the reason that we need to figure out some kind of plot that ends, but the circumstance is generally transformed into some kind of interpersonal thing. In Murphy, even early in this like first season, almost all of the plots are like, I have a source who wants to tell me something, but we can't get that source on without me compromising a journalistic value that I have. How are we going to wrap that up in 27 minutes? And I think the later seasons tend to be a little bit more like, you know, I just am having a fight with you over our stupid shoes or like something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was a journalist, I was always upset when my problems weren't resolved in 27 minutes. Television might have set an unrealistic expectation for me.
There's also, it's funny you say 27 minutes because it's 22 minutes now. So it is interesting that, like, as over the years, more and more ad time means, you know, less and less actual screen time. But I wanted to just talk about something to rewind to the political angle for a second, because this show premieres like 10 days after George H.W. Bush is elected. And it ends pretty knee deep in the Clinton administration. And then it comes back in 2018 as a reflection of, you know, the Trump administration. And I can understand the notion of what does Murphy Brown have to say about Donald Trump's America, for lack of a better way of putting it, right? Like, there is something there. I did not watch the revival. I'm assuming you guys did.
Some of it. I don't know if I watched. No, I ended up watching all of it because we did a podcast episode about Murphy Brown. So, like, I watched because Diane English only agreed to talk to us because she was trying to get the revival renewed. And so we, like, talked to her about Dan Quayle and then didn't put any of the stuff about the revival in the episode, which is fine. It's how the soup gets made. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm just it is interesting to me when it was announced with Roseanne, with Will and Grace. I was like, this makes sense. And I understand, like, that's a compelling, interesting, what is Murphy like in 2018? But America's just complete uninterest in it was really kind of shocking to me. Like, just a total disregard. Yeah.
You hadn't been able to see it for so long. Like, it's because this show has, like, significant music rights issues. And they ironed them out for syndication, but it didn't play well in syndication, probably because the humor is inherently about, like, political figures who we no longer care about. This episode has a joke about Paul Tsongas, who's, like, you know,
everyone's favorite.
I know who that is because he was a distant cousin of a kid I grew up with, but, like, that's the only reason I know that. So I think that it never played well in syndication, which meant it didn't have, you know, Will and Grace, Roseanne, whatever faults you want to find with them, they lasted forever in reruns. So people knew those characters. It just didn't happen with Murphy Brown. I actually, at the time, had a great pitch for what show should be revived, and we'll talk about that later.
Oh, great. So, can't wait. I want to give just a little bit of context for the people that maybe have not watched Murphy Brown, which, if you have not watched Murphy Brown, thank you for listening, but I don't really know why you are, but that's great.
Hi.
Murphy Brown is a television sitcom created by Diane English, as we mentioned, premiered on November 14th, 1988 on CBS. It stars Candace Bergen as the titular Murphy Brown, a famous investigative journalist and news anchor for FYI, a fictional CBS television news magazine, and later for Murphy in the Morning, a cable morning news show. Was that what the revival was about? Or what was she?
Yeah.
What was that?
Yeah, so I think what happened, I believe the premise of the revival was Murphy and her son are on competing morning shows, and his is on a thinly veiled Fox News ripoff, but he's not like a conservative. He's just like,
he's trying to be reasonable.
Yeah.
The series originally ran until May 18th, 1998, airing a total of 247 episodes over 10 seasons. And then in January 2018, it was announced a 13-episode revival, which we mentioned, premiered on September 27th and was canceled at the end of its run. The show, what's interesting too, and you guys kind of hinted at this earlier, but, like, the single mother, single woman that doesn't, quote unquote, need to be completed by a man, is something that really kind of broke through. I mean, obviously you have shows like Ally McBeal, Sex and the City, Desperate Housewives, Good Wife. Like, there's lots of shows of independent women, as much as I hate that moniker, that benefited from Murphy Brown, I think. Like, it does feel like Murphy Brown was the tip of the spear in a lot of ways. Would you guys agree with that?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just, but then, like, you run down that list of shows and, like, all of
very different,
very different, very, very different. And, like, many of those shows are examples of women who you can feel already the way they have been, like, softened by, like, let's not go all the way Murphy Brown, you know, but, like, she's, I mean, even The Good Wife, where the whole point is that she's, like, trying to split off from this husband who is bad, is, like, well, she's the good wife. She starts as that we see her standing next to him. And it's like, can she have an identity separate from him? What would it be like to go back? And the fact that Murphy not only doesn't, like, you know, she doesn't need that man in the beginning, but the whole premise at the beginning is just like, and we're proud of it. And we're just going to shout about the fact that she's never had this kind of role in her life. I don't know of another, I mean, I guess there probably are shows a little bit later, or they tend to be more like crime drama-y type shows. They're the like detective figure, and she's all like grim and angry.
Hard as nails.
I mean, don't forget the Mysteries of Laura, Deborah Messing.
Who could forget the Mysteries of Laura? I as you were talking, Catherine, I was thinking about the horrible label of unlikability, this idea that to this day, as I pitch things, you have to deal with. Like, it's still a thing. And it's definitely more of a thing for women than it is for men, for female characters than male characters. And I feel like Murphy really walks that fine line. And I say that part of it is Candace Bergen, who I can't imagine another human being portraying this character, because she has this prickliness and yet at the same time, a charm and a watchability. Like, she is really walking that line, which I think is so key to this whole thing working. You know, I think that Candace Bergen, whose career is fascinating, and we'll talk about her just to sort of unpack her and where she, but still, like, when she pops up on Sex and the City in the later seasons, it's a breath of fresh air, but it's also like, she means business, and she does. Carrie is just like too soft.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I keep thinking about the pilot. She comes back in the elevator, and they have hung this like "Welcome back, Murphy" sign.
Sure.
And they are worried that, and she like is not. She comes off the elevator and she's like, "Hello, everyone. How are you doing?" She's like very polite, and she's very excited to see everyone. She goes in the office, and they are. And then immediately you hear her scream at her new secretary, which is one of the jokes of the ongoing jokes of the show, that she can't keep a secretary. Yeah. It's not always her fault. It's like often they're completely ill-suited for this job. Yeah. Sure. You hear her scream at the secretary, and they say, oh, thank God she's back. We missed her. And it just as a way to like write that little thing that like she's prickly and we like that about her, to communicate that just from the first jump of the show, I think is so baked into what this whole show is about. Yeah,
it's really
for sure
it's really interesting to like situate Murphy Brown as a character within the waves of feminism. Let's just talk about that. Because the way that she is like a character is like she gets to do all the things a man would do, and she's great and she does them all well, but also she gets to like yell at her secretaries and like be just a total asshole to them. And like, I don't want to say that like Murphy's like the most toxic person alive, and a lot of those jokes are funny. I mean, my favorite, honestly, is when it's on Seinfeld and Kramer is her secretary. Yeah. But it is that's a joke that if you're just watching Seinfeld on Netflix, just must be like, what the fuck is this? But yeah, I like there is this thing of like, okay, she's just women can do everything men can do, and they could do it exactly the same way. And then you look at Sex and the City, which is like another wave removed. And Sex and the City is like, no, there are elements of femininity that are worth traditional femininity, mm-hmm. how society presents it to us, that are worth incorporating. And it is just this real, really distinctive drawing of a line, because I think Candace Bergen's a fascinating figure in that she grew up in old Hollywood, like became a performer in new Hollywood, and now has this really unique ability to transcend generational lines, no matter how old she is. And like, I think that's why it makes her a good figure for those sorts of roles.
Well, it's, you know, talking about feminism, but I did an episode on Ally McBeal for our 99 podcast, whenever the hell I did that episode. And there's a Time magazine cover, which you guys might remember, or Newsweek, where it's like glorious. You're seeing the various faces of like, it's, I think it's four women, and you're seeing sort of the, you know, the arc of feminism. And then it's Ally McBeal. She's like literally next to Gloria Steinem. And it's like, is this what feminism has become? And I'm just sort of like, I mean, Ally McBeal was a huge show. She was very much sort of an icon, I don't know that she was a feminist icon because she was constantly like turning into a cartoon character or falling downstairs or talking to cartoon babies mm-hmm. and like wanting to have sex with guys in car washes. Like it's all
Guess
very
what?
Sort of.
This is feminism too, everyone. It's a big tent. Yeah. We're coming in.
That's kind of how it felt, right? Yeah. Where it's like you have David E. Kelly, who a very, you know, obviously an enormous figure in television and a guy who was able to write all sorts of different types of female characters for what it's worth. Like I think that he's an interesting writer, but a feminist writer, not one that I would necessarily give that moniker to, which is,
do you think David E. Kelly made a deal with some demon that if he doesn't write a TV episode a day, he will die? So he's just like writing legal notepads full of like some show we'll never see every day.
Truly.
Well, I wondered if he has some kind of deal. And then like part of that deal is, because it's like a deal with the devil, and often those deals are like sure. legal dramas. He's like writing out his own devil legal drama every time. It's just
would watch replaying. That show.
He's I'd replaying in his head that what the defense attorney would say to try to get his soul back. Right? Would be so good. Oh,
that's fantastic. Yeah. I do think it is interesting that Murphy Brown, which is, you know, I don't want to say mired, but is existing in a very sort of politically fraught time. It's certainly, you know, that 92, we're going to talk about 92, but, you know, this episode that premieres, the episode we're talking about is 2 months before the election in 1992, when Clinton is going to win. And
as predicted by my second grade class vote, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Amazing. But I do think it's kind of fascinating that I have not seen the entire run of this show. You guys have. But the episodes I watched, and I watched 4 episodes. I watched the pilot. I watched the finale of season 4 and the premiere of season 5. She's taken all sorts of pot shots at Republicans, like pretty just, you know, all. Just, and I was just like, is that a hallmark of this show as well? Like Republicans are idiots. Is that basically one of the things too?
They did do a fair number of like Bill Clinton is a sleazy horn dog jokes, but like they, yeah, it's very much weighted toward making fun of Republicans. I think a thing that is true of political culture in the 90s is mm-hmm. that it's lower stakes. The Cold War is over, but we haven't yet entered the heavy polarization of the 21st century. So like there's this idea that, oh, we can all laugh at how stupid Dan Quayle is. Or, you know, we can all laugh at how Bill Clinton, you know, is a horn dog. But, you know, I think that that was not as true as the show would have suggested. The roots of the polarization we live through now are being planted in the 90s.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And
absolutely.
Like Rush Limbaugh's coming to the fore and Fox News.
And they are mentioning like the Middle East. Like she's making some shots about that.
A
too.
Lot. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think Emily is I would agree with Emily's general assessment of this idea that like you can have like James Carville and Marley Matlin like on TV like mm-hmm. is that what is but no Marley Matlin's not the, what's
her name yeah
what's her name
Marley Matlin
the no, woman Marley married
no the woman he married whose name sounds like Marley Matlin but isn't James Carville and his wife who's a Republican Mary
James Carville let's see who his wife is
they would be on TV and they would be like talking heads against each other and he was the Democrat and she was the Republican
yeah. Mary Madeline
okay
very
so you
close
can,
you're
you
very
can
close.
See my problem
yes
but they would be like next to each other on TV yeah. and it would be like they're married but they're on opposite sides of the spectrum and they're gonna fight sure, and it's sort of like sure. fun back and forthiness in a way that does not feel like right now if you were to run that segment it would be like and here's why they're not getting divorced we swear right like yeah. that's the only way you could have that kind of
plus
I've
the
seen.
Husband and wife on different political parties has been how many television shows? Like, I feel like yeah. I've that pitch has been said a million times and it's definitely been on TV.
The literal next show Diane English makes, the show she leaves Murphy Brown to do is J. Thomas and I think Annie Potts. It's called Love and War. And
oh,
they are
right.
Republican and Democrat and they're married and they have these politics that don't work, but they just want to fuck. And yeah. like, that's, yeah. you know, that's
how
the
long
premise.
Did that run for?
3 seasons. It was behind Murphy and then they moved it and of course it lost course all its it, yeah. audience.
And wait, and Jay Thomas shows up as am I crazy?
Like,
as like a, her yeah. ex or something like that? He's
like
the
a
father
love, yeah.
of her child, I think.
Well, so she has an ex and his brother is her lover, and so you're not actually clear which one of them is the
interesting. Father. Okay. Sure. It should be said, on the Candace Bergen side of things, she wins 5 Emmy Awards for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for this show. And Am I correct that I have a vague recollection of a year that she took herself out of consideration so Helen Hunt could win for Bad About You? Am I crazy?
She just stopped competing because she was like, I've won enough awards. I don't need to win anymore. Y'all can have fun. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
So, then specifically Helen Hunt wins the next year for Bad About You, which everyone kind of, felt like she was losing for.
There was kind of this, like, John Larroquette set this expectation of you win so many Emmys and then you quit. And she, like, set the record. She, like, I think she beat Mary Tyler Moore. And she was like, okay, I'm done. And now, like, right. that expectation kind of doesn't exist anymore. Also, TV shows don't, you know, don't have that sort of run. So it's less of a concern.
Sure. Yeah. So she starts her career, obviously she's in features, in the late 60s. I feel like Carnal Knowledge is the movie that kind of, I don't want to say puts her on the map, but the movie that kind of, or at least the biggest movie I can kind of see here in terms of her feature career. She's in a lot of movies that I didn't know she was in. Gandhi, for instance, your favorite movie, Emily, Gandhi.
One of the things about it, the book Oscar Wars, which is mm-hmm. I don't remember who wrote it, but like there's a whole chapter in that about Gregory Peck's attempts to make the Academy younger, and like his like point of reference for what the young people like was Candace Bergen.
Sure.
Because she had grown up in this world. Candace Bergen was kind of just famous for being famous for a while. Like, she was the child of a famous person and she was beautiful. So now she's famous. She has like a weird connection to the Manson murders. Candace Bergen.
She does?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
The house that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were renting, they were renting from Candace Bergen and her boyfriend. And
okay.
Like, Charles Manson was mad at her boyfriend. So there is some, like, speculation that he was going after Candace Bergen and just, like, you know,
that's
she was not there.
Crazy. In features, it feels like in the kind of 2000s, she becomes the mom to the guy of our protagonist sort of thing. Like, she's like Patrick Dempsey's mom in Sweet Home Alabama. She feels like she's kind of in this...
Sometimes she's like a
moms.
Lady president, you know, that sort of a...
Sure. She's in The Women, which is Diane English's remake of the classic film in 2008, which had like Meg Ryan, Annette Bening, Eva Mendes, Deborah Messing. Everyone was in this thing. And I don't think anyone see that movie? Was that a movie that existed?
It killed Diane English's career. Like,
yeah.
Literally, it was just like, yeah, no one saw it. And like, yeah, just I feel like I for whatever issues I have with Murphy Brown, I think Diane English is like this groundbreaking figure.
Sure,
and
sure.
She just kind of like, it never happened for her again. And that's, you know, too bad.
It is too bad. But I mean, I think that, you know, Candace Bergen on television, because of Murphy Brown, is obviously this enormous icon. She, as you mentioned, shows up in a 92 episode of Seinfeld, which is kind of amazing, called The Keys. She obviously is on Sex and the City as Enid Frick. She does 3 episodes of that. And then she's in like 84 episodes of Boston Legal. Like, she's just, I mean, she's just working. She's also
make that money. Make that money. Yeah.
She's also great in Let Them All Talk, the Soderbergh film that came out during the pandemic with Meryl Streep. Like, she's still an amazing actor. I don't mean to qualify that by saying still, but like, she's, you know, she's getting up there. But it is just, I don't know that people, certainly millennials or Gen X, have a fair assessment of how iconic and how great an actor she is. I mean, which is just sad, but that's just what it
well,
is.
Well, I mean, yeah, because other than Let Them All Talk, where I do feel like that conversation did happen
yes,
a little bit.
Yes.
She's in that like book club kind of. She's like one of the wacky old ladies, and they she wasn't, as far as I know, in the one where the old women go like Tom Brady, but you know,
she's not in 80 for Brady.
But you could imagine like she would have been in conversation for a film like that, and that's kind of the way. And then she's like the weird, horrible one on the Sex and the City, like, you know, that whole pocket. And it does not fully encompass the like long history of who this person is.
It doesn't.
I kind of fucking love Book Club, though. The first one.
Oh, I certainly did not mean to denigrate the Book Club.
I didn't think
film.
You did.
Like, did you see the second chapter, Emily?
I didn't. No, it was. It came and went. I need to watch it on.
You go to
it came and
this
went
time,
from my local theater. Yeah. So
your local theater.
Yeah, well, I have a theater. I have a theater like three blocks from me that I see everything at, and they don't get everything. Okay. Like, they never got Sound of Freedom, which is how I don't know what freedom sounds like. But
someday you will. Obviously, it's a shame.
So, Book Club: The Next Chapter came out in May of 2023. This year, I think it did relatively well, all things considered.
This year? Wow,
it was this year. It actually didn't do that great. It cost $20 million and made $27 million. I think that people maybe were just like over Book Club. I don't know. But she's in
people
it.
Just, you know what? They need to start doing the Book Club spinoffs. The thing is, they didn't make movies about the individual four women in the Book Club and then have them come back together. You know,
like that a cinematic universe, if you will.
Well, or like the romance novel. That's the way any romance series has
done
smart.
It.
Yes, right?
That's smart. Perfect. Yes. Yeah. Perfect. Yes.
So in terms of this episode that we are talking about today, you say potato, I say potato, one with an E. The episode synopsis, for what it's worth, after the delivery, Murphy goes through her period of adjustment to motherhood, interviewing nannies, trying to decide on a name for the baby, and trying to get a good night's sleep. This episode was written by Steven Peterman, Gary Donitz, I don't know how to say his name, Corby Simas. Again, these are all really hard names. And directed by Peter, I don't want to say Boners, but I think it might be.
It's Peter Boners.
Boners, sure. Yeah. Give it a little je ne sais quoi, if you will. 44 million people watched this episode of television.
Well, it was so hyped.
It was.
But still, that's a lot of people.
I mean, it was like the news story of like the summer. Like it was enormous. Yeah. Yeah.
Can we all agree this episode is padded and did not need to be an hour long episode of television? Or
yes. yes. There are parts of this episode that are padding that I am nevertheless like happy are here. Sure. Should we talk about like what this episode is and why
absolutely
it exists
please
before we get into the specifics?
Go for it. Yeah.
So please. So in the season four finale, mm-hmm. Murphy has a baby. And this is a huge deal because mm-hmm. she has decided to continue a pregnancy, although she is well over 40 and not married. In the premiere episode of this show, which was four seasons ago, it says like she's over 40. So by the time she has this baby, you know, like she's definitely not young. And she's not married. She's not in a romantic relationship or any kind of partnership. And she decides to have this child. It is a continual like question, and she's worried about what her career is going to be like over the course of the fourth season. She has the baby in the in season four finale. There's a really moving, just lovely home video footage style shot ending scene where she sings "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman" to the baby, which is also a callback to the pilot because she sings that song in the pilot. You're just like overcome with this big, I mean, the TV is like, I can imagine what the TV guide covers looked like, right? Sure. About this episode, just huge deal. And then over the summer, Dan Quayle, real life political figure and vice president of this country.
Known intelligent man. Known as a brilliant scholar.
That's correct. Dan Quayle. Also famous for not knowing how to spell the word potato.
Clip is one of the best TV clips you'll ever see. If our listeners should go on YouTube to see him scold a child and tell him he's spelling potato wrong.
I have such incredible nostalgia for like the moment of our political lives where like that was a big deal that like mattered also.
Yes, totally. It's great. It's wonderful.
Anyway, in the middle of like a much longer speech, this is not like the point of the speech. It's just like one line in a bigger speech about the dissolution of family values and like how this country is falling apart. Sure. He says, "And you have Murphy Brown out here making a mockery." I can't remember. We'll find. Yeah. I'm sure we have the exact quote somewhere.
I have the quote.
It's like making a mockery of like traditional family values.
Mm-hmm.
And so then. It's like a whole summer of press that's like Dan Quayle versus Murphy Brown, fictional character Murphy Brown, which is
It's insane. Talk about picking a ridiculous fight, but yeah.
And they're up for Emmys that year. They win several. They win comedy series. Candace Bergen wins. And it's just like, you read the press coverage of those Emmys, and it's just about Dan Quayle. It's the most 1992 thing imaginable.
You even have Bush.
Yes.
Basically being like, they have a clip of him as well, where he makes some sort of, you know, offhanded joke about how, I'll take another question about Murphy Brown. It's amazing how much it swallowed what feels like the waning months of his campaign for president. He's fighting a fictional character. It's insane.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And so then, of course, like, all right, you're coming back for season 5. She's a new mom. The vice president of the United States has picked a fight with your fictional character, but also with, which I think is important, like the whole idea of her and like what your whole show has been about and the whole premise of like what you are trying to do in culture. But he's just like, I think accurately in that respect, chosen like the exact right target. Like, this was the thing. This was precisely what she was trying to be. So like, what do you do with your returning television show?
Yeah. I mean, it's handed to you. Like, there's no world where the writer's room or literally the showrunner sees these clips and is like, well, this is just, you're handing me this.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to take it.
And
but I also don't know that it's the best caveat for an episode of, for a premiere of a show.
Well, in another show where it was not already very embedded in like political coverage, like regular back and forth with like real world political events, I think you might have sat and thought a little bit longer about like how exactly we are going to incorporate this into the world of the show. There is an element of it that's like, we already do this. This is kind of a gimme. Like, let's just go, that you could kind of feel to the construction of this episode. But it is, I mean, in spite of, I agree with you, not being the best episode of television ever, just a wild thing to watch.
It's wild to watch. I mean, it made me think about, and this sounds weird, but bear with me for a second. Do you remember when, like, Contact, the movie, got in trouble for using Bill Clinton's footage in the, in the press conference, he was talking about something that they found on Mars, or I don't remember what it was, but they took his words out of context and used it in the context of Contact, and like the administration was not thrilled about that.
I thought you were talking about the movie Closer, and I was like, when is Bill Clinton in Closer? No, it's such a weird choice.
Very different movie. But it makes me think about how, I mean, obviously you can do whatever you want. I assume this is public domain footage, right? Like, once it's out in the world, you can manipulate it kind of however you want. The funny part about this is there's no manipulation. Like, they don't literally have to. It's right there for them.
I mean, this is also like, this is the period when Republicans are like picking a war with big pop culture, a war I would argue they eventually kind of succeed at, but this is the opening days of that. Cause you know, George H.W. Bush is like, we want more families like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons, a thing the Simpsons responds to. And that's a show that like can bend reality a lot more than most shows, but it's very much like, you know, and obviously Simpson is like a common last name, but it's still very weird when Homer Simpson's like, what the hell? And a thing that I think gets left out of the Dan Quayle narrative is he was doing a racism. He was like at this speech that was about like the decay of family values. And what he meant by that was like black single mothers. Yes. But then he talked about a fictional white lady and everyone was like, whoa. No, yeah, and like in the episode of Primetime, my old podcast, in which I recorded under a very strange name, I don't know why I did that. We talked with a scholar about that, and then also with Diane English, and it was just like Dan Quayle was trying to make an entirely different point that was racist in its like very core, and it got distracted by this conversation about a white lady, and ultimately like a fictional white lady, and ultimately like, that was one of the things that led to his defeat in the presidential election. But the larger thing of, we're going to use pop culture to make racist points that like don't seem racist because we're talking about white people, is like a strategy that Republicans pick up and like run. No,
totally. It should also be said too that like he tries, they try, and I can only imagine in a myriad of ways to try to kind of round the edges off of this situation and try to like be playful about it. Where like Vice President Quayle sends fictional baby Avery a real plush toy elephant.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what world are we living in now? We're sending gifts to fictional characters to try to make it seem like we're not callous.
Well, I mean, there's something I really love about that, because it is kind of playing on the same field, the same incredibly non-real field that he, sure, he himself created by like baying it in the first place, right?
Right,
so like,
right,
why not pretend? I mean, given the news cycle, she is essentially as real or functionally,
that's
more
true,
real than any real person could have been. There is this way, it's my favorite thing about fiction, like because it is fiction, we are able to access it and like grapple with reality in ways, sure, that like we can't when something is actually real, because the facts are too, they don't fit, and like the narratives aren't clean enough. And so actually it is a lot easier to talk about all of these kinds of things when you can talk about a fictional version rather than, you know, the actual factual frustrating thing. So yeah, like send a fake baby an elephant, I don't care, that's fine. It's all about the gesture anyway. Like the whole thing is just about, yeah, rhetoric and gestures and how it gets covered.
Well, and as you said, like you've created another reality anyway. I guess you can send an elephant to that reality if you want.
Fine.
I mean, we all remember when Mike Pence sent Lamelia Clark like a fake, like a stuffed, yeah, dragon, and was like, sorry for your loss, queen, you know, right, like
we called her mother, I believe, but yeah, yeah. I mean, so, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre. It does feel like, I mean, Emily and I have existed in this 1992 journey together for a while now, and it does feel like a different world in so many ways, and obviously in many ways far worse than the world we live in, and in other ways very quaint and kind of oddly idealistic. Mm-hmm. But Emily, you look like,
honestly,
you
I honestly had not really thought about how different it was, you know, watching all the movies. This made me be like, oh, what the fuck, like watching
television TV is for.
Watching television of a time period, of a certain time period, is just like being dropped into it. And like, you know, I think the more that we try to make TV quote unquote cinematic, like the more we lose that quality, which is what's great about TV. That, like, I'm obviously, you know, I don't care. I think that shows that are, some of those shows that are more movie like in their construction are great. And some of them are, you know, wonderful.
It's a balance.
But yeah, you need to have a show that reminds me a lot of Murphy Brown in a lot of ways is Superstore, which sadly left us. And it's just like that show. That show ran for 6 seasons. That show, I loved that it was like every week, it was like a thing that they were dealing with. And it, like, if you watch it now, like it's already starting to slip a little bit into the past. And The Conners does some of that too. But like the thing that streaming has taken from us is that element, because streaming is constantly trying to like make it seem like you could watch this at any point in time.
Well, it is often totally unmoored from when, like, it was written, it was shot, it was, first of all, it was written completely in one chunk, then it was shot without being written at the same time, which is, all of these shows are written in this like cycle where it only comes out like 3 weeks or a month after you wrote it, so that the freshness of it is much closer. And then even farther from the writing is whenever it comes out in front of an audience, it could be a year or 2 years, even longer, before anyone actually sees it. So it's totally unmoored from that specific texture of the moment that it was written, which also means that I'm sure people who are writing are trying to be like, well, I can't make it like too specific, because like, who knows if this particular thing is still going to be the thing in 2 years, or that kind of stuff.
It's also like, now there's this real fear of like, the country is so deeply polarized. If you make a Trump joke, are you turning off a ton of viewers? Are you like, and also now Trump's not president, why are you making a Trump joke? You know, it's like this delicate balancing act that, like, I think when TV was more immediate, I'm looking at a show that overlapped with Murphy Brown. It's one of my favorite sitcoms. Everybody Loves Raymond. Its first couple seasons were up against the last couple seasons, or after the last couple seasons of Murphy Brown, I think, something like that.
After.
Yeah. And I just mean like aired after at one point. And that show tried to be timeless. That show tried to be, we're going to tell a story that you could tell at any time. And it is, you watch it now and it's like, yeah, this was made in the late 90s, early 2000s. It's just like inescapable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, we're also talking about a format that doesn't exist as much as it used to, which is the multicam.
A shame.
And I do think that it does feel, I don't know what it is. I'm not a comedy writer, so I'm sure that a comedy writer could maybe explain this to me better. But I don't know why we have struggled to keep that format alive. Like, I know that the single cam seems more filmic or whatever the case might be, not as
just an aesthetic thing that happens right. with trends, right? So there's that right. element of it.
And,
yeah.
and it is very interesting to me that, like, when you look at the fact that Gen Z and millennials can't watch enough Friends, like truly cannot watch enough of that show.
And so many of them grew up on Disney Channel Nickelodeon sitcoms, 100%. Which are multicam.
Exactly. Sweet Life of Zack and Cody.
Right. So what are we doing? Like, how is it possible that there isn't some cool, hip, you know, youthful writer out there that wants to do that now?
I'm glad you asked.
Oh, yeah?
I did so much work on this issue over the course of my career as a critic. Sure. I did a lot of reporting on it. I think there's a bunch of different issues that are at play here. One is that executives just don't think those shows are cool. They're not the shows that executives want to watch. The second is that the multicam to some degree relies on a shared sense of reality that we no longer have. It relies on the broadest possible jokes. Chuck Lorre was like the last like
vestige
to mogul of that. And like his shows increasingly just became sex jokes because he was like, sex is like a thing we all still understand.
Yeah.
There wasn't
sitcom. It's why stand up comedians always end with like the sex joke at the end, because that's the big thing that you can end. And it's like, what if you had to take your closing joke, but it was your whole show?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, there's like no shared political reality, nor is there a shared pop cultural reality. So Chuck Lorre's just like, I guess we all have to like, you know, do things with sex sometimes. There's also this element of Friends sets up an unrealistic expectation of being able to have all hot people in your show and have them all be funny, which is not true. Whereas you look at a show like Seinfeld is the show that immediately precedes it. Those are like distinctive looking people. Even Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's beautiful, is a distinctive looking person.
Sure.
The last thing is, this is something a writer once pointed out to me. The people who come to Hollywood to write television want to write films now. It used to be they were playwrights, and playwrights are great at writing multicams. Mm. And now there's just not as many playwrights, or if there are, they're getting shuttled into drama. You know, there's a lot of great.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, yeah. the playwright thing, having worked in an agency for several years when I first moved out here, the playwright thing for agents is like such a coup, because you can get some cool, hot playwright and showrunners who I guess have this self-hatred of what they do want to incorporate playwrights, because theater is real writing and what we do is bullshit, or so they think. So it's like you'll have shows that get packed with playwrights, none of which know how to write television, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I guess we need actual TV writers.
I mean, I had been trying to be a TV writer for like a decade, and then I wrote a novel and everyone was like, you must know how to write television, and I was like, well, what I really want to do is be a low-level staff writer on a basic cable drama, a pay cable drama.
It's had this identity crisis since its earliest days. It's one of the most fascinating things about this medium.
But what's interesting though, just to come full circle to some degree, is that I think that multicam is theatrical. It's why playwrights are good at writing that, because it's in front of a live audience more times than not. They understand just the rhythm of it is so similar to theater. It's a shame that we're weirdly getting away from that. But anyway,
I think the multi-camera sitcom, this is a slight hyperbole, but only slight. I think the fall of the multi-camera sitcom is why we have a polarized country.
No, I'm with you. I believe Norman Lear was like the person who was holding this whole country together. I mean, the 60s was not a great time, like political polarization wise. And yet we still lived in a shared reality. Is it a complete coincidence that All in the Family was on? I don't think so. And that like everyone had to watch it because there was only three shows, and that part of it's bad because only white people and white men could make shows like that. There's its own element of it. Sure. But we could all sit and watch Archie Bunker, and some of us misread it, but most of us did not. And America made it a couple more decades, and then we lost the sitcom.
Like the one of the other things is like, I think the multi-camera sitcom is a safe space for people to get used to ideas they've never heard before.
Yes.
there's this like, it's totally possibly just like causation is not correlation, but I really genuinely believe the study that famously tracks the acceptance of marriage equality against the run of Will and Grace. And it just like goes. Mm-hmm. So like Will and Grace, if you are a gay man living in 2023, a lot of people have problems with that show, with Jack, sure, the character. And I think that's fair. But to some degree, the multi-camera sitcom is built atop stereotypes. I know if there was a multi-camera sitcom with a trans woman in it, I'd be like, what the fuck are they doing? But like, they would use a broadly stereotypical character and get you to like sort of laugh at their stereotypical traits. But then there would be like, this person has humanity. And it's like this weird, like sort of sleight of hand thing that the multicam can do that no other TV genre can. And I think the loss of it has been, I mean, I wrote this article at Vox a long time ago, based around the Carmichael show. Yeah. And one day at a time, and all of these, there was like a run of politically conscious sitcoms at that time, and then, you know, they all kind of left the air, they all kind of failed. I do think, you know, I think it's just this thing where there's a whole segment of the populace where if you like make fun of Donald Trump, they assume that you're like personally making fun of them, and like you can't do that kind of broad-based comedy in that environment. For all its faults, the Roseanne revival briefly did and briefly tried. And like, that was interesting. And then, you know, Roseanne was not a great person, weirdly.
Turns out, not great. I do think, though, it is interesting because I feel like this episode speaks to everything you guys are talking about as well, right? Now, admittedly, there aren't as many channels on in 1992, but 44 million people watched a pretty overtly political episode of television. And my assumption is that Republicans and Democrats were able to watch this and both get something out of it. And I think that that speaks to what you guys are talking about, which is, I don't know if it's the multicam. I think that's definitely part of it. But I also just think in general, the country wasn't as divided. They were able to kind of make fun of themselves. It's not a surprise that, you know, the leader of the Republican Party right now is a man who cannot laugh at himself. So none of his followers can take a joke either. All of this speaks to what you guys are talking about, which is, you know, I don't even know if it's division so much as it's literally Trump making sure that these people feel the way he feels, which is that, you know, a victim all the time and angry about it.
I mean, the polarization that became really obvious under Trump had been building for a long time.
Absolutely.
And you're seeing the early roots of that in this episode. Someone made fun of me for the way I say roots the other day, and I'm not going to stop saying it the way I say roots. I grew up in the upper Midwest. Yeah, you can like the end of this episode is kind of a thinly veiled Rush Limbaugh reference. Sure. And like that's, you know, it's the rise of this. The real thing that changes all of this is Bill Clinton repeals the Feinstein laws, and like Reagan repeals the Fairness Doctrine. Yeah. I think it was Reagan. And like, so suddenly there's this right wing media ecosystem that eventually becomes a self-sustaining bubble. And now they like have their own movies and TV shows. And like, you never have to leave that bubble. And like, in 1992, you had to leave that bubble to continue to exist in the world.
Right.
And Murphy Brown exists. Yeah, go ahead.
And then at the same time, streaming algorithms created bubbles for everyone in the sense that like you only ever see the thing that the computers think that you want to see when you turn on any of your screens. And so.
And shows not needing, you know, shows being sort of calculated in such a way. And I don't even mean now. I mean, even 10, 12 years ago, where you could have a show that gets 1 million, 2 million viewers of dedicated fans, and that was fine. It still is fine. I mean, who knows what the numbers are for streaming, because we'll never know. But I think that's
what we're on strike for. We're on strike specifically to learn the numbers.
But I think there is something to that. And it is a double-edged sword. I mean, as a fan of television, if a show can be so specifically aimed at me, how is that necessarily a bad thing? It makes you feel rewarded. At the same time, I think the universality of what used to exist is getting lost. And I think that they're learning this the hard way. And one of the myriad of reasons we're on strike right now is because of this, which is that the specificity actually doesn't really help you in the long run. And you actually do need things that are a bigger tent.
Again, a balance. Like it would be great if there were a couple of big tent show or like more big tent shows that existed and that weren't, you know, Law and Order SVU.
Sure.
Because this is the other element of this, is that there is still a kind of a large tent, and it is police procedurals, and like, sure. and that has nothing to do with the brokenness of our
or like Abbott Elementary and Ghost or whatever. Like there are right. a couple, but
there are a very couple, and I mean the success of Abbott is also like you could it is unfortunately the one that you point to, and you're like, see, it could work, and everyone's like, I don't know how we could ever do this again though. Like that's just that one.
Impossible. Yeah.
And like, I think the success of Yellowstone, while that show is deeply flawed and it is very much existing in a world where Taylor Sheridan is talking about things that people care about and is like, he has much thornier, more interesting politics than people assume. But it also is kind
Emily,
of a show.
We cannot turn this into a politics of Yellowstone.
Yeah, we can't do politics of Yellowstone.
We can't do politics of Yellowstone. We're doing next hour.
It's too much.
Yeah. Podcast like it's 2019.
Podcast like it's Yellowstone. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I think there is this room. This is not television, but you look at Barbie and Oppenheimer, and they are two giant things everybody's going to see, and everybody's like wrestling with, you know, basic tenets of feminism and should we have dropped the atomic bomb, which are like big questions to be thinking about, honestly.
Yeah. I agree.
Pretty big.
It is interesting. I mean, there's no question that the landscape of television right now is huge. It's incredibly broad, and that is in and of itself a good thing. Like I don't mean to suggest that I want four channels again and to become incredibly universal and perhaps a little bit too myopic at times, but I do think that looking at these episodes, watching the finale of season four, which is...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This kind of breaks format a little bit in terms of all the kind of talking head stuff. Like it maybe predates all of the various documentary shows that we now have, but we have sort of this beautiful kind of interstitial thing of Frank filming our leads as they're talking to the unborn Murphy's unborn child, which did make me kind of go like, it was a little jarring to think about like what audiences must have thought of something like that. I feel like you both of you know the history of television better than I do, and I'm sure that there are any number of shows that have broken the format prior to this. But that's pretty bold to do in 92. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like when we come back for the season 5 premiere, you're feeling a little less of that. It doesn't feel as special. I guess my question to you both is, do you not think that the season 4 finale could have been a series finale? Like that it should have perhaps just been...
No, can't have been. Because the whole point is that she's working, right? Like this is like the career story has to be the Murphy story. Like you cannot end with her holding a baby and being like, I'm a woman now. Like that, cannot be the button on this show. But emotionally, like I completely see what you're saying about the way that they were able to find fictional experimentation to signal that something unusual and special was happening.
Sure.
It's time for my favorite soapbox, the episode, which is a thing that lets you say, hey, we're going to do a different format right now, and it's not going to break the rest of the show. And everyone understands that in 1992, because Northern Exposure is out here doing God knows what crazy ass shit for an hour. Yeah. And then you come back and you're like, hey, it's still Northern Exposure. China Beach, moonlighting, like Twin fucking Peaks, all of this stuff was out here saying like, yeah, for 1 hour we get to do whatever the fuck we want, and then we're gonna come back and there's a status quo, and then we can do different shit. And so, yes, deploying sort of interesting format breaking episode stuff for that season finale feels very TV language to me, and also does exactly what you're talking about. It's like signaling this kind of special moment.
You know,
unlike
so go ahead. I'm
you say potato, I say potato with an E, or I say potato, you say potato with an E. Is not a bottle episode, not to return to your favorite point.
I was
going to
say,
but,
I wonder if Catherine has thoughts on the bottle episode.
But it contains one thing that makes many people confused with the bottle episode, which is Dan Quayle talking about the main character by name, as so many
100%.
Bottle episodes
That's
do.
That's a constant, and I'm just perpetually saying, if Dan Quayle is talking about your character, it's just not a bottle episode, guys. I have to add it to the list.
First of all, I could not agree with you more, Catherine, in terms of episodic television. The idea of, and I think that there really does need to be a distinction between episodic television and procedural television. I think that a lot of people think those are similar. They're
well,
not.
They often come together, but they're not the same.
But they're not the same thing, correct. Yes. And I do think that one of my many hopes on the other side of this strike with ad supporting and all sorts of stuff is that I think we're going to get larger episode orders as well. I think short runs are also not helping television either, because you're burning through story far too quickly. But yes, Emily, you look at your
order. No episode order should be under 13. I feel like we found this. I obviously there are exceptions. I would not want to watch a 22 episode Fleabag. I think it would lose some of its like power at that length. But like,
but that's a British model. But yeah. British model is also slightly different.
It's also very strange, yes.
Yeah.
But I do think that like there was this period when everyone was like, well, we should make TV like the Brits. They make it better. And the reason we think that is because we only get their best shows. If you actually go to Great Britain and watch their television, there's all kinds
so
of
true.
Crap there. Like,
thank you.
I obviously there should be some shows that have less than 13 episodes, but I do think we found this like kind of perfect length for a TV drama season, serialized TV drama season of like 12 to 13 episodes. And then we were like, what if we took more episodes out of it? Obviously, I love when there's like a Lost or an X-Files that runs a whole bunch of episodes and has kind of a serialized story sprinkled in there. But like, if you want to do the kind of tighter thing, I think 13 is perfect, because then you do get a couple hours to kind of like Sopranos always did.
You were talking about the bottle episode, or you're talking about breaking of format episodes, and you know, when you're sitting in a writer's room and you know a sort of formula has been built for your television show, it gets tiresome, right? So writers want to do something exciting and want to do something weird. And I think most of the time that's exciting. And you see it in the fucking narrative that comes off of Twitter or social media. Whenever a show does something really exciting and new, people get excited about it. And
or
which is a different way of saying it.
Remember
exciting.
How mad people got about Fly, that great Breaking Bad episode?
I mean, how crazy is that?
That aired the same night as the Lost series finale, if you want to just like be at a moment. Two episodes that people were famously normal about.
Yeah, totally normal about. I mean, God, it is.
I love that.
Yeah. I do think, though, also part of this is people didn't have the opportunities to speak out about television in the same way, right? So you could talk to your friends about it, or you could, you know, shake your fist at the sky on your front lawn if you were angry about an episode of television.
You could write a letter,
which people did a lot. But now, I mean, Emily, you've talked about this a little bit, about sort of, you know, your message boards were sort of the first wave of all of this, right? Of people being able to find common groups so you could all kind of bitch and complain or be happy about television shows. Now, the fact that you can tweet at someone is pretty fucked up.
I remember when Arden, the podcast I made for two seasons, when it was like suddenly had this audience of people, and they would just occasionally say stuff, and I'd be like, that was a creative decision we made. You don't just get to say that we were bad. Like you can disagree with that decision, but you can't just assume that we had no idea what we were doing. And then I was like, oh no, I've become
LemonLyman.com. LemonLyman.com.
Now, you know, like I was very, very early in the Yellow Jackets fandom. And now, like, so I was like in the subreddit and everything. And now every time Reddit's like, you used to read a lot of this. Let's look. And I'm like, no, I can't. I need to run far away.
I can't. Yeah, you can't know anything about it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do think, though, looking at imagining what Murphy Brown, like, and I'm not talking about the revival, like this show, if this show existed,
I'm
going to
see if there's a Murphy Brown subreddit. Continue.
I bet I'm sure there is. But it does feel like a show that probably would have been a bit of a lightning rod in that way. Because if it 100%. Was already.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If Dan Quayle and Murphy Brown are on, you know, cover pages of magazines and newspapers, I just can't even imagine what people would do with something like that today.
There is an r/Murphy Brown, but it's a private community. You have to ask to be invited. Yeah.
That's very nice. Well, I would bet it's a private community because they're all sharing illegal links of how to actually watch this show. So it can't actually
that's true
be,
too. It's true.
Can't actually be public. Yes.
I don't, no, did we, totally, is it just right. music rights? Is that what we've, that's
one of the big reasons. Okay. And like they put season one on DVD and like with the music intact, and it was very expensive and it sold terribly. So they just never did the rest, which is why the episodes we watched had a whole bunch of Nick at Night bumpers in them. Wonder how we got them.
Who knows?
It's very impossible to say.
I do think, though, you know, I talked earlier about the episode feeling padded a little bit, and I do feel like there's just stuff in it. I mean, listen, if I had an entire summer of building up to the episode, I'd want to do a 2-hour special episode or a 2-part big hour-long episode. Sure, I get it. You know, get your money where you can. And I'm sure advertisers couldn't wait to get their commercials. So I get all of that. But there was stuff that, as nice as it was, like the Frank scene where he's teaching her how to hold the baby, is a really nice scene and feels sort of counterintuitive to the Frank stereotype of him being sort of this womanizer. The fact that Frank is a womanizer is hilarious. The way Frank looks and he's a ladies' man in 1992.
I would fuck Frank.
Absolutely. That guy has something just ineffable about him. Well, so I wanted to talk about that specific scene. Because I think so, I certainly did not watch this show contemporaneously because it was my bedtime. But I'm trying to remember when I first went back and like watched it as an adult. I think it was after I had kids, and pretty soon after I had my first kid, I think, because I think I wrote something about it, and that shot early, not necessarily the Frank showing her how, which like it didn't need to be that long and all that kind of stuff, but there's a shot earlier where the baby starts crying and she picks up the baby out of this cradle and is holding this baby in the way that you hold a cat who you think is going to claw you, right? Like, she is holding this baby in the way that makes anyone who's ever held a baby go, oh god, And I was sure it was a fake baby. And then you turn it around and like she is holding a real baby in the most disconcerting. Like,
I genuinely, the way the light hits the baby's bald head makes it look so fake. And I was like,
it looks so fake.
Have we just had like really bad, has fake baby technology crumbled so far from the 90s?
And you're like, oh no, it's a real. No, but there's something like really, really powerful, like in like a brainstem way thing for me, watching her hold that baby that way, because actually like that communicates so much more about like where she is in this moment in her life than like any of the rest of what happens in that episode. Like, I mean, eventually, yes, you have to get the whole arc of it, but the ability for her to go from, oh God, this baby, to like holding the baby in a fairly natural, like, I do not think I'm going to defuse a bomb kind of way. That's the story for me. Like, that's the arc of the episode.
And it speaks to also why the child is crying so much is because the child is terrified that it doesn't have something to actually protect it and care for it,
because it's dangling out in midair.
Right.
When I brought my child home, I did hold them above my head.
Sure. Yeah, you got a Lion King.
Screaming. Got a Lion King at least once.
Yeah.
I was just like, I got this bomb here. Oh my
god. Yeah.
But I don't mean to suggest that that the emotional arc of these two episodes, which is essentially Murphy starting to understand how to be a mom, is lovely. And I have no problem with that. I think that it just felt like it had air in it. You know what I mean? And it felt like it just could have been a really tight 27 minutes.
This is an amazing episode about a woman who never thought she'd be a mom, figuring out how she's going to be a mom, and then also figuring out how to return to work. And then in the middle, they have to talk to Dan Quayle.
Yeah, like...
Yeah, the speech to Dan Quayle is incredible. And I do feel like that is kind of, I guess, that's almost an episode unto itself. Because basically in part two, Murphy goes back to work and scolds Dan Quayle through the television, basically saying, I mean, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but these are difficult times for our country. And in searching for the causes of this country's ills, we could choose the media or the Congress or the administration that's been in power for 12 years, or we could blame me, which I mean, it's really well written. And you know, and then her saying perhaps the president, vice president should expand his definition of what a family means to him, since they come in all shapes and sizes. I do think that the message, I put that in quotation marks, but like the theme or the thesis of this episode is great. And I think that they do find a way. And Candace Bergen also said, I don't know when she said this, but also said that she didn't necessarily disagree with Dan Quayle saying that men are not important to, you know, that fathers aren't important, which comes back to what you were saying earlier, Emily, which is that it was all coded dog whistle bullshit, and that it wasn't really about, you know, gender necessarily. But I do think that that's an interesting thing of that this show does that dance that today would probably be impossible to do, of navigating landmines, seeming not, you know, like some kumbaya moment, but also feeling just funny and smart. And it's pretty impossible what it was able to do at the time.
There's, I can't put my finger on this, so I just want to raise it as a point of discussion. Catherine, please, if you don't care about this, talk about something else. But there's a thing in the plotting about her dealing with her baby that just it felt very clear to me that it was written by men and directed by a man. And I can't quite, it just was something with the way that they just didn't get some of the little details right. Some of that's like,
there's one woman. Yeah. There is one woman that wrote this, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yes. There. Her name is, forgive me, Corby Simus is, I believe, a woman, if I am not mistaken.
Corb, come on the pod. Let's talk about this.
No, I mean, I just wanted to point that out, not to say that. Sure. I think what you're saying is absolutely true. That's why I want to, see if there was a female voice involved in this. That did a pass, perhaps?
No, I think you're right. I mean, it does, the way that they write through her like exhaustion and the baby waking up over and over and the sort of like wisecracking at the baby as he continues to wake up, and the kind of, it feels very like you're imagining a dad telling it at work later. Right. Rather than the person who was actually like waking up and doing it over and over and over again. It doesn't have, like, speaking again from my own lived experience, it doesn't have that thing where somebody opens the door and then you're like weeping and laughing at the same time and you literally can't say a sentence and you're like, what is happening to, like, there is just a level of collectedness, which I think makes sense for Murphy as a character and for the way that this show tends to approach like serious issues. Like, it tends to have that sort of safe humor remove. But the thing you don't have when you have a newborn is a safe humor remove. Like, you've lost it. You desperately wish you had that still, but it's been skinned away. I can totally see that.
I also feel like a scene that
I need to remove this cat. I'll be right back.
Okay. A scene that I did feel like I don't know would be in the episode had it not been a two-parter is the scene when she goes back to work or tries to go back to work in a trench coat and a baseball cap and is just desperate to escape from her home and from her child.
Yeah.
Which I think is handled really funny, but also feels very
they needed
sad
a beat.
Too.
Yeah. They needed a beat. Well, and so the episode that comes immediately after this is, of course, like rehashing a lot of this kind of stuff, because then she actually does go back to work full time. And then it's like nanny stuff, and she feels nervous about the baby, and like, how does she balance? So you can tell that it was like, yeah, we're gonna do that episode, we're just gonna also kind of do it here to like build out a little bit more of what this has to be.
And Eldon becomes the babysitter, is that what happens, or is sort there a babysitter hired?
Yeah, so she hires a nanny, that it becomes a little secretary like Eldon then is the babysitter for a bit, and there's a nanny, and then the baby, as all good sitcom babies do, becomes more talked about than ever seen again. You know, like, bless them. I prefer that. Like, if you're gonna do Murphy Brown, be Murphy Brown and like make a lot of jokes about how much you really hated going to your kid's second grade production of Showboat, which is a joke she makes later in the show. And I was like, no second grade is putting on.
Emily's did. I think Emily, you were the lead in Showboat, right?
Yeah. The, it was unfortunate because it was all white school, but you know,
real story. I was in a pit orchestra for an all white production of Showboat, except for they got one kid to be the guy who sings Old Man Ringer. They had Olin River. They had to get a black kid from a different high school.
I mean, that's a better solution than
it is a better solution
than others would have been.
Well, except then they also put wristbands on half of the white cast to show that they were actually black.
Wristbands?
No, sorry, like armbands.
Oh, armbands. Wow. Different time. It was a different time, guys.
It was 2002.
Maybe I shouldn't move back to Michigan.
There are some great jokes in these episodes. I did really like Murphy. She goes back to work and then she has to go home, and she says old Bessie has to get back to the barn for her milking. The sadness with which she says that, the resignedness of it. I do like when she says it's like having a conversation with a porpoise. Like, there are definitely some great jokes that Candace Bergen nails. Every one of them is the thing too, where like, even if the joke is kind of a B minus, her delivery somehow gets it up to an A every time.
Yeah. It's a little funny watching, because, you know, I have watched a fair number of the, there's a whole genre of this kind of show now, right? There have been like, there was one called Up All Night, there's Working Moms, there's like a lot, there's like a whole little subculture of these.
Yeah.
And the mom as cow joke is like very familiar territory. Sure. The, you know, the I feel like a insert like aquatic mammal here, like all of this sort of stuff. Sure. But what you have to remember is like, this was 1992 and it was Murphy Brown. So just those jokes would have felt, I think, very different for an audience watching in primetime then than they do when you're like, Netflix has served me Working Moms because it knows. Right.
The joke that I laughed at, where I was kind of ashamed to laugh at it, was something like, I finally have a chest worth paying attention to, and the only man who will doesn't know what to do with it. And I was like, it's entirely because Candace Bergen is like, perfect at delivering those jokes. She's just nails them.
She really really does.
She's much better at it than I am.
So I did, as we sort of wrap this up, I wanted to ask, outside of Murphy, who is your MVP character wise
interesting,
across the whole show or just these episodes?
Both show and these episodes. I'm going to go first just because I don't have as much invested in this, it seems, because you guys really want to chew on this, which is totally fair.
Yeah.
The character that spoke to me the most, that I thought was the funniest, is Miles. I think that Grant, is it Shoud? Shoud? I'm not sure how you say it. Shoud, I pronounce his last name. Just really in the pocket. It feels like his introduction, even in the pilot, you really are just sort of like, this guy gets this. And it's not, they're all very, very well drawn. You know, Jim is incredibly well drawn. Corky's obviously very well drawn. Frank, like, they all are perfectly cast. They all kind of know their lane. But there's something about him being so young and always over his skis, and this idea of sort of the young male executive. I thought they did a great job of making that feel fresh, which I imagine in 92, you know, whatever.
It would have.
Yeah. What about you guys?
I just want to say, one of the things about this series that clearly indicates that it came from like the kind of feverish brain that becomes a great showrunner is just the whole device of Eldon.
I was going to say, Eldon is insane.
How is he still? How did they milk that in terms of
The idea is, so like the idea was sort of like Murphy's going to face off against the conservative world, but then she's going to have this further left guy who's like here, he's like a burnt out hippie type.
Right.
And he paints her, he's painting her house for the whole run of the show until he does kind of become the nanny. But occasionally he'll be like painting a social, like social commentary mural on one of her walls. And she's like, wow, that's great. And she like, she really likes him and has this like comp, like, he's kind of the Wilson from Home Improvement of this show. Like Wilson from Home Improvement is really kind of a ripoff of Eldon.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that he's my favorite on the show outside of Murphy, but I think he's interesting. I like, I guess
it's just so sweaty to me because I'm watching the pilot.
That's the point.
I know, but it is just kind of like, it's a, to your point, Emily, like it's underlining it and it's shining a bright light on it in order for you to kind of just get past how absurd it is that this man in overalls is just always there. And he's
Also such a like long TV history of like landlord, neighbor characters. Totally. So there is a way that even though it is incredibly sweaty, you're like, oh, it's Kimmy Gibbler, or like, oh, it's like every other version of this. It is so true. It like when you do like a pantomime, like a classic old English, like there's like the this character and the this character and the this character. And so when he comes in, you're like, guy, and he's a leftist and he's painting like revolutionary murals.
I mean, yeah. We all remember the season of Family Matters when Carl kept Urkel trapped in the basement, and like that was the rationale for why Urkel was always there, because he couldn't escape. Like,
for real?
No, Phil.
I don't know. I never watched Family
Matters. Did you know that across the run of Family Matters, Urkel became a born again Christian? That is true. That happened.
Wow.
I know that there was like there was a time when he was cool, right? There was like they flipped it.
He had like a machine that turned him into Stefan Urkel. Urquell.
It's been a long time since I've watched this.
Let's do an Urkel episode, Phil.
Yeah.
I'm in.
I mean, so favorite character. I mean, I want to stand up for Frank. Because I do think Frank is a really crucial take off that toupee, Frank. I do think Frank is a really crucial figure as far as like what makes this show work. He's like close emotionally to Murphy. He often demonstrates like a softness that she doesn't. It's not that it's fully like a gender swapped thing, but that you were able to see them having this platonic relationship over the whole course of this show. And the way that they are often competing for stories that feels healthy and fun and friendly, I think is really effective. The tenderness that you see in an episode like this. I want to say I also went back and watched both strike episodes of Murphy Brown because I was like, what happens when this show goes on strike? And like in every case, I mean, by the second one, like Frank's out there with like signs and he's like teaching Corky what a scab is, and it's great. It's great television. So we stand up for our labor king.
I was going to say Frank as well. I think Frank is a really interesting, compelling character. He's not as much a comedic type.
Yeah.
He's kind of like there. Have you seen Taxi, Phil?
I have.
He's the Mary Lou Henner of Murphy Brown.
That's interesting.
He's there to be like, there's kind of a romantic frisson, but not really. And he's just there to be like, well, we all know that not all men are that way, you know? Mm-hmm. And God, he's hot. I want to marry Frank. Except then he'd just cheat on me, and that would be sad. But I'd be fine with it. I'd be like, Frank, you got to do what you got to do.
Emily, you could fix
him. You could fix him. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I do think Frank has a great moment. Frank has a bunch of great moments in the season four finale. But when he's pulling the things out of the bag that he picked up from her house for her, and it's just a series of underwear and a stapler and some chicken from the fridge. And I mean, it's what's great about it, and again, like this is, I think, speaks to what you guys are talking about, the specificity of the voice of his character, but just sort of how completely overwhelmed and it's, again, like this is part of the multicam thing, I think, which is that the characters can also be dialed up just a little bit more than they can be normally. Everyone's sort of existing on like they're almost cartoon characters. They never get to caricature. And I think that
In single cam, I feel like everything has to be just a little bit more grounded.
Well, and then you do the dialing up with like angles and stuff.
You don't get
to do it in dialogue, performance in the same way.
No, I agree.
There are a number of single cam writers who have tried to launch multicams and failed in terms of like the network, just like Dan Harmon's done it, I think, a couple times. And it's just I think Dan Harmon understands the rhythms in his bones. Yeah. I want to see that happen. I think,
you know, what I also think would make a great multicam perhaps is
Emily St. James.
Well, obviously, I was going to say Liz Merriweather. I feel like, you know, New Girl had that kind of crackle to it. Like New Girl, I think, could have straight up
been, and she was a playwright, so
you know, this is like a much more left field suggestion, but I was talking with Sterling Harjo about Reservation Dogs, and I was asking him like what TV he watched, and like it was all multicams,
really.
And yeah, well, because, and so like I was trying to ask him about like how does he think about like episode structure for that show, and he has a very specific, like, that is kind of what native storytelling is like, these like little tiny anecdotes that live in their own little bubbles, which happens to map neatly onto that structure. But like all of his TV rhythms are like, he grew up with like, you
That's
know,
interesting.
Multicam sitcoms. And, you know, talking with him and Dallas Goldsmith about that show, like I would so love to see like a native Absolutely. Multicam would be
amazing.
I do. And like one of the things about the multicam is that it has traditionally been a space where like America is like forced to sort of confront the ways in which it sucks.
Yeah.
I do like wonder if there is a thing where poor people of like our generation and older, these multicam rhythms are so embedded in us that it's impossible to find them funny again. And I'm wondering if as these younger generations, Gen Z, my child belongs to Generation Alpha, I've learned, or possibly,
Alpha?
Possibly,
gone all the
I think,
way back around?
Possibly, I think they're calling them like the Echoes or no, the Polars, because they grow up in a polarized America. And I'm like, my child is a baby.
My children the Echoes?
Probably. I think they are.
Yeah.
I think it's like Congrats. If you were born after 2015. So
Claire's a cusp. She's a cusp echo.
Well, you know, you saying that made me think of another line that I loved from this episode, which is near the end of the episode, Eldon is trying to coerce Murphy into making a statement about the Danquil fiasco that has kind of created itself. And she says he's a baby, not a political statement. And I do think that that's a great line. And I also think, you know, Jesus Christ, politicians could maybe stop using children as cudgels.
That so resonated with me as a trans mom who briefly was breastfeeding until it became very annoying.
That's so true about breastfeeding.
but I was like, listen, if I, you know, that was when I was still at Vox and I assumed I was going to come back to Vox. And I was like, should I write about this? Should I talk about this? Because like, it's a thing people are always surprised to find out, which is that literally any human can breastfeed a baby if they have the right hormone cocktail. Mm-hmm. But like you say that and certain people freak the fuck out. And I was like, but this is my kid. I don't want to turn my kid into a political football. And then I got fired. So we didn't have to figure out how I'd answer that.
Not
question.
Because of that, though, but just to be clear.
And then I talked about it on a podcast at the end of an episode about Murphy Brown. So
that's right.
But I do think that like one of the, and again, having not watched nearly as many episodes of you as you guys have, that this show can slip in a line like that, that is really powerful and throw it away. Right. Like the way that Candace Bergen delivers it, it's not like, you know, Aaron Sorkin would, for instance. Right. Like, I think that it just as a possible, you know,
you know, Sorkin has his place. You want a soaring, score. Sometimes we humans need that to respond.
Sorkin should reboot Murphy Brown.
Oh boy.
It'd be terrible. I can't
I wish
wait.
You all could see the look on Catherine's face. Yeah. I can't tell if it's horror or elation.
I don't know. It's a real kombucha girl response that's happening inside my body right now.
But I guess it just goes to show that like, these two shows are obviously over a decade apart in terms of their premieres, right? Obviously, The West Wing is an overtly political show. And I think that this show, and by that I mean Murphy Brown, finding a way to exist in this kind of political maelstrom and be funny and be, you know, I mean, the fact that Corky and Murphy exist on the same show is also a way of just sort of making it clear that, like, women come in all shapes and sizes. They are, there's a spectrum here. They don't need to just fit into one thing.
Yeah, and they represent second and third wave feminism. So yeah.
They do. 100%.
Corky's great, it's true.
I think Corky, the way Corky, for as much as the show
uses her as a punchline. Yeah.
Well, uses her as a punchline and then also slips in its later seasons. Total arc of Corky as a character is one of the stronger recommendations for, like, Murphy Brown as a complete show. Because
does she end up with Miles at some point?
She gets married to Miles and then they get divorced, and then I think she gets married again, but, like, by the 10th season, she's sitting, literally it's her and Lily Tomlin who takes over the Miles role, and Candace there's an episode where Murphy Brown is trying to decide whether to have a total mastectomy or a lumpectomy, and these are the kind, like, it's a very long conversation, and so they all decide to, like, make a major decision about their lives to support her in her need to make this major decision, and Corky's like, I'm going to therapy, and then and Lily Tomlin, like, gives her a psychoanalyst's card and tells her she's going to get, like, a referral discount. Like, it's great. Really good things about season 10.
I'm seeing here that Corky marries someone and her name becomes Corky Sherwood Forrest.
Yes.
For a little while.
Yes. But it doesn't stick.
I mean, the Miles and Corky getting together thing, again, I don't know. The episode
was very news radio.
It made me think of Niles and Daphne.
Daphne, yeah.
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 In terms of, like, you know, nerd getting hot girl, basically.
The tale is old this time.
Yeah. Beauty and the Beast. I do, like, one thing I love, like, we mentioned that sort of powerful line, and one thing I love about the multicam is that the live studio audience becomes a character, so you can do a dramatic moment and the scene shifts because the audience watching it shifts. Like, I think Cheers was probably the best at that, and incidentally I teased this earlier, but I think Cheers should be rebooted. I think somebody Cheers.
I think Cheers,
because it's built around a bar, is like uniquely well suited, and it tells stories about class, is uniquely well suited to do a season where there's a whole bunch of new people working there. Ted Danson comes in every so often. Some of the others come in every so often. I think there's, like, I think Rhea Perlman's probably, like, the regular you bring back, but, like, I think there's, like, real room there to do something interesting in sort of that Lego sequel.
And the sports CTE storyline, like, that you can write that itself, because Coach was never, because he was constantly forgetting stuff, and so that's an easy rewrite now. Like,
And, like,
do you guys remember the show Abby's? Speaking of Cheers,
yes,
remember this?
Yes, and it starred name?
It starred Natalie Morales, and it was produced by Mike Schur, and
I reviewed this show.
She had, like, a bar in her backyard.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, like, I remember reading about the premise and being like, that actually sounds fun. And it was multicam. I never watched an episode of it, but was it like, just because you brought up Cheers, Emily, it made me think of, like,
it was 100% one of those shows that, like, needed to live with itself for a certain number of episodes while it figured out how stuff clicked, and it did not get that runway. Right. And then, you know,
and then it died.
The premise was all there. It was a pretty sweaty pilot. It was trying to, like, shoehorn in a lot of, like, this is this person. And, you go back and you watch that Cheers pilot, and, like, you can't believe how gracefully it manages to do all of that work. So I don't know who you get to write the Cheers pilot that can create that same kind of casual sort of ease to it.
Well, some of it was.
It's conceptually just for a set in San Diego. The series takes place at the home of Abby, a bisexual Latina ex-Marine sergeant who turned her backyard into a bar.
Hell yeah.
That's a normal sentence.
The thing about the Cheers pilot is they rewrote it like 17 times because they kept coming up with new angles for it. And like, so like by the time it was on the air, it was like really finely honed.
Yeah.
Before we wrap, go ahead.
Before
we wrap, can I read to you the lead of my Murphy Brown Explained article from 2018? Because it is some real Emily St. James on her bullshit stuff. This is going to be a little bit, so I apologize for you're just going to hear my voice for a while.
Okay.
In their 1997 book, The Fourth Turning, authors William Strauss and Neil Howe attempted to explain American history by a series of endlessly repeating cycles, with each one spanning between 80 and 90 years. In Strauss and Howe's telling, you can reduce the country's history and human history more generally to an endless sequence of crises, leading to reunifications, leading to awakenings, leading to unravelings, leading to more crises. An idea within The Fourth Turning that feels particularly resonant in 2018 is that of the Gray Champion, taken from a famous Nathaniel Hawthorne short story in which the ghost of an old man shows up to taunt some British soldiers in the 17th century. The Gray Champion is an older person whose interests align with a younger hero generation in the midst of a vast crisis, and the resulting coalition of the great man and the great generation summarily ends the crisis and saves the world. Past gray champions have included Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so, you know, big shoes to fill. The Fourth Turning is one of those works of pop sociology that feels incredibly convincing as you read them until you realize just how feverishly Strauss and Howe are working to force history to conform to their thesis. But it is kind of compelling how they predicted in 1997 that the 2010s would be another crisis period when society would seem on the brink of utter collapse and a gray champion would emerge to carry forward the hopes of a new younger generation. The obvious question then is, who will our gray champion be? Barack Obama? Hillary Clinton? Donald Trump? Elizabeth Warren? Ted Danson? Well, what if it was Murphy Brown? What a lead.
What the fuck? That is the most Emily shit I've ever heard.
They just let me get away with all kinds of bullshit until they didn't.
How did they let you get away with that from an SEO perspective? You got to get Murphy Brown in the first like 20 words. Otherwise,
The headline does have, you know, Murphy Brown all over it. And this was back when you could do like an SEO specific headline and have it kind of work. But yes,
that's incredible. Emily. Yeah. That might be, I mean, I might need to make that into like a poster print that you can frame and put on your wall.
Thank you.
Because that is incredible.
Sucker. Yeah.
Wow. You really covered the gamut.
Who is our great champion?
You are a great champion. That is, I don't even really know what to say to that. I mean, that's incredible.
Thank you so much.
I do think though that like, just sort of a grander question as we wrap this up, but like, does Murphy, if there was a Democrat in office, would Murphy Brown have got made? If you understand my question, like you've got two terms of Reagan, right? Obviously you have Jimmy Carter before that, but like you've just this swath of Republican bullshit. I feel like this show being a reaction to that has to be a selling feature, right? Like it has to be part of how it gets made. Is that a crazy notion? Or do you think that she's not nearly as sort of, okay.
I don't think it's a crazy notion, but I do think there was going to be, for reasons outside of like strict Republican Democrat breakdown, there was going to be some show that was like, what if Career Woman, but maybe too much, like because of how, because of just the way that the entire like cycle of women's role in the workplace had finally gotten to a place where you might have a woman who is over 40 who is actually at the top of an incredibly visible media industry, right? Like it was a collision of a lot of different things. Would it have taken the specific shape that it did where that career was newswoman who yells about politics? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. But there was going to be some Murphy-esque figure at the head of one of these things in some form or another, I think. Yeah.
You know, it's funny too, because I was rewatching The Newsroom recently.
Oh, wow. It's Emily and my favorite show.
Yeah
you guys love that show. That show's crazy. I started rewatching it because, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. But
because you love it.
No, because I did a Studio 60 Patreon episode, so I watched all of Studio 60, and then I was just like, oh,
you were let's jonesing.
See. I was like, let's see what the new, I haven't watched The Newsroom since it aired. Like, what's that like? And it's weird, guys. The Newsroom is weird. But
The Newsroom, HBO, 10 p.m. new.
What would it be right now?
What's the name of the main character again? Will interrogates Will Ron DeSantis about how he's weird. Yeah. Maggie can't.
Oh, yeah. They're going to bring on an AP Psych professor to talk about why you can't teach AP Psych in Florida anymore.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then they're going to also, this AP Psych professor behind the scenes is going to give them all like Enneagram exams where they find out their personality types, right? That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Maggie interrogates whether trans women have an unnatural advantage at swimming by having a race against Emily St. James.
Yeah.
Phil watches all of the newsroom. That's the plot.
The reason
that
I bring this up is because I feel like weirdly Mackenzie is Aaron Sorkin's Murphy Brown.
Oh God.
I can't say that you're wrong, and I'm so sad about it. It's like if Murphy Brown fell over a lot, right? Like
if Murphy Brown had a head injury, she would be Mackenzie. McHale, of course.
Oh my God.
But yeah, it's just it does feel like, obviously both these shows are newsroom shows and all of that. And Lord knows television loves to make shows about television, about making television, but like only in a kind of cursory way. Like they don't really want to get into the nitty gritty of it because like no one really cares about it that much. Turns out most people don't care about it at all. but I do think that like that's Sorkin's Murphy Brown. I think that's what it is.
So depressing.
That's great. You know what?
It feels like the right way to end this episode.
Yeah.
First of all, Catherine, thank you for coming on.
Of course.
But where can people find you? Where can they read you? Where can they
give your home address, please?
Yes.
Yes.
I am still on the platform formerly known as Twitter. I will probably always be there until it dies, but I'm trying to look at it less. I'm trying to have it be less of the major part of my life. But you can find me there. I'm also on Blueski. I'm kind of liking it over there in the Blueski space.
It's pretty chill over there.
It is pretty chill. Good.
Yeah.
There's a lot of you know, pets, and there's a custom gardening feed I get really into. I'm on Instagram also. I'm sure you can figure out all there's you know you all of the ways
for it. Yeah,
I'm
sure.
Around. Yeah,
you're around, and you're still at Vulture, obviously. So
I am.
People can read you.
People can read me on Vulture. I write about TV. I write about comedy specials. We're just getting going on a very big project that's going to take many months before it actually exists. So I'm not going to talk about it right now, but I've been watching a lot of very old TV at Paley for it, which is the best.
That's exciting.
Awesome. You are one of the people who I still read and one of the TV criticism space and one of the people where I'm like, she might someday write a long lead about The Fourth Turning by Neil Strauss. which will include the line, I forgot to read this. Look to the east. There your great champion rides, America. She is the great baby boomer liberal lion, Murphy Brown.
Wow. Yeah.
That's a t-shirt.
That is. Look to the east.
Look to the east.
It's Murphy Brown.
Well, people should read you. You are one of my favorite TV critics out there right now.
Oh, that's so nice.
I'm honestly thankful that you took the time to talk Murphy with us. It's truly an honor. We hope that you'll come back and talk about something else in the future. Some other television show that needs to be spoken about.
Or Beethoven.
No. I refuse to make Catherine talk about Beethoven.
Have seen a lot of Beethoven.
Have you seen all the Beethovens, though?
No. Okay. But
there's six of them.
No, I think I've seen three, but I've seen one 400 times. So, like, does that count?
Your kids are big fans of Beethoven?
No, as a child, we had the VHS. We didn't have that many VHSs, so it was like that and Homeward Bound. No, but then we would also have to talk about the Air Buddies universe, which is my most, what happened to dog movies. And my God, if you don't know what happened to dog movies, I have a story for you.
What happened to dog movies is the new future book by... But I mean, you had only VHSs of Animals in Peril?
No, but my dad would go to the library and then illegally rip library VHSs, but only if it seemed like we would actually like them enough to make it worth, because it was kind of illegal and he would say that, but then he would still do it. So it was like I was getting a lot of mixed messages, but we definitely had Beethoven. And I don't know, we watched it just over and over and over over and over again. Yep.
So that was your introduction to Charles Grodin, was Beethoven?
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah.
I mean, Emily can't wait to do our Beethoven episode. She speaks of it pretty
consistently.
It
was also my introduction to Charles Grodin, come to think of it.
That's like normal. What are you talking about?
I think mine was Heart and Souls, if I'm being completely
honest. Okay, I mean, that's fine, but
it's a good movie, though. But Beethoven, you know what? I've never seen Beethoven.
So there's a line in Beethoven. This is a Beethoven episode now. We're starting again. There's a line in Beethoven where she rolls over and it's the dog. He's in bed with the dog, but he doesn't know it's the dog. And the dog licks his ear and he goes, "It's not even Friday." And I was like, what does that mean?
What happens on Fridays?
What is adulthood like? How do I decode like this specific?
I guess Friday night's the only night they have sex. That's married life for you.
That is.
I don't know. Yeah, but these are things we will unpack on our future Beethoven episode at some point. Thank you so much, Catherine. This was
pleasure.
An absolute blast. And and we hope to talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.